So we were talking about the laboratory.
Yeah, so it was analytical, wet analytical lab, and at that time, you know, you had to learn everything, how to analyze. You got solutions with various ions, anions and cations in them, and we made color reactions and precipitations, you know, all the old stoichiometry. So you learn an enormous amount of hands-on chemistry. You knew, you know, what is a gas, what compound is a liquid, what compound is a solid, what is their color, are they poisonous or not, how do they smell, sometimes even how do they taste, because you had to use pipettes.
Hopefully not the poison ones.
Yeah, hopefully not. We deal with that at that time, you know, with horrendous acids and fumes all over the place, and it was just, you know, tremendous, you know, hands-on chemistry. And then we also had, late in second year, I believe, organic chemistry lab. That was my personal nightmare too. Organic chemical reactions, you know, you had to go to the library and look up how things are being made. And there was a book called Vogel, if my memory is right, which had the recipes. And so, of course, you had to translate them, you know, these were all in, Vogel was in German, if my memory is right. So you had to translate, figure out, you know, and write down the steps, what you do. So then you worked out what chemicals you need. Then you had to stand in line, you know, to get, you need 3.4 grams of this and 17.9 grams of that, etc., etc. So you got that. Then you start, doing the work. And so you go through this recipe. And the way Vogel is written, or was at that time at least, you know, like, I just make this up for you. Put in 3.4 grams of potassium bromide. So you stand in line, get 3.4 grams of potassium bromide and put it in. Then you continue reading. Which you previously have to solve this. Oh my God. So you ruined the whole thing. So as a result, you know, I was really suffering in, I passed, but I was suffering in that lab. After the 15th step, you were supposed to filter out some, let's say, beautiful white crystals, and all you had is a brown glob kind of floating underneath some suspicious looking liquid, you know. So you filter it out, you know, so now it's on the filter paper. It looks horrible, of course, you know. And you go to the professor and want to show him, and you drop it. So there's all this work is on the floor. So I didn't like organic lab. I'm just kidding. But one has to learn it, and it was useful. I survived, you know, obviously. The very interesting thing is, perhaps historically speaking, that the professor, young professor who oversaw our organic labs, he told me he wants to talk with my father, or vice versa, I don't remember. But my father advised him to, you know, be tough. So he was. And many years later, the same professor became the dean. And he nominated me for an honorary doctorate at that university. and I got it. And I went to, you know, receive my honorary doctorate at the university. And we said, wow, this is really remarkable history. The way the world functions and evolves is amazing, you know. Because at that time you didn't have much hope for me. And now you have nominated me for an honorary doctorate and I won it for you, you know. Anyway, so it was a good hands-on education. We had all kinds of labs, physics lab as well.
So if the organic lab was kind of your least favorite, what was the best class or best laboratory that you took while you were there? Is there anything that really stands out?
I don't think that I... In the early years, you know, they were all kind of the same, very hard work, enormous amount of material to learn, etc. Later on, I kind of drifted into liking electrochemistry. And so I did my thesis, which would be like a master's thesis, I guess, here in electrochemistry.
Did you have one particular professor that advised you on that thesis?
Yeah, they assigned you to professors. I was under Professor Petro, P-E-T-R-O, who was a rather well-known catalytic chemist. So I liked catalysis as well, and later on, you know, it became my kind of home base eventually.
Now, I'm just curious, of the students in chemical engineering, was it all men at that time?
No, it was about, rough memory would be 50-50. There were lots of ladies as well. In chemical engineering, and a large number of foreign students at that time. They mostly came from the then time communist countries. We had Bulgarians, I remember. We had some North Africans, a few. So quite a number of foreign students we had as well. And as I said, they learned Hungarian. The education was in Hungarian, and it's a difficult language to learn, and they learned Hungarian. It's just remarkable to me. How did they do it? Because I met so many people who have tried. You know, we know people who, you know, married some pretty Hungarian girl and then spending the next 30 years trying to learn Hungarian. So,
you mentioned that when you were doing the organic lab, you'd have to go to the library and read the Fogel publication and translate it from the German. Was there any difficulty that you were aware of in terms of getting publications or perhaps kind of up-to-date information from the West?
That was never considered, never thought of. I think the philosophy at that time was that you don't necessarily teach and learn, you know, very up-to-date things. You want to teach and learn well-established things. Certainly, you know, at that level, I'm sure the professors, when they did their research, you know, they were more interested in the leading edge. You know, we were kind of taught mostly modern but basic things. And we were then, okay, we were then exposed to current literature in doing our thesis work. So you had to do literature search, etc. At that time, you know, there was no internet, of course, there were no computers. And you went to the library, and the university had a great library, really a beautiful building, you know, kind of probably built in 1900 or before, you know, a very glorious building, huge shelves, and you could climb way up, you know, and find various books and bring them down, you know, and get your dictionary and try to... We had chemical abstracts available. So we didn't feel, at least I as a student, did not feel that you don't have access to anything. But in reality, probably, I would assume the access was probably limited, you know, if you did kind of forward research. But we found what we thought we need to our work at that level, mm-hmm. students, you know.
Now, one of the things that Jacqueline and I know from some of the other oral histories in the collection, mm-hmm. and of course just from general historical readings, mm-hmm. is that during the 1956 uprising, the university was one of the main sites of that. Did you have any personal connections? You had personal connections with the university through your father and then later your brother, but did you have any connections to that uprising in 56?
I was a high school student, you know, and I was 15 years old, and there was a big Russian statue in kind of diagonally across the high school. And so, you know, obviously the students wanted to level it, but you couldn't touch it. It was enormously strong and heavy and made of reinforced concrete, covered with marble. You know, it was really a kind of industrial strength. So, you know, then people came, you know, and tried to attach some ropes to it and pulled on it, and of course didn't have the remotest chance. Then some people came and brought very heavy, you know, wire cables, kind of military grade, and attached it to the end of a truck. And tried to pull it off, and of course that lifted up the rear of the truck. Then came with a caterpillar, kind of an agricultural machine came, you know, and they attached this big heavy cable to it that lifted the caterpillar. Then more people came, you know, and finally they came with an air jackhammer. And then they did it properly, you know, they dug under it and then used the caterpillar, and finally a huge celebration, you know, the thing was leveled. So the Russian tanks, when the Russians came, you know, to beat on the revolution, the tanks came from east to west, and Solnok is the place where, you know, you cross the Tisa River, and it's the main road from basically Russia to Budapest. So all the tanks passed through Solnok, and there was huge rambling, you know, and as they made their turns, they dug into the road, you know, and there were all kinds of things going on, you know, and most people were hiding. Probably would be shot, I would assume, if they go close to what's going on. So I remember that we listened to the radio all the time. You know, there was Radio Free Europe, which everyone was listening to. Things changed on a daily basis. It broke out on October 23, and as you know, November 4 is when it was beaten down, so it was a relatively short time period in which, you know, Hungary declared itself to be neutral, you know, wanted to exit the Warsaw Pact, and etc., become a neutral country. Eventually, you know, this whole history, you know, well documented, the Russians beat it down with enormous force. Many people died, a couple of hundred thousand, you know, managed to go through the border to the west, which is a large percentage of such a very small country, of course. And by the time, you know, I ended up at the university, those were really dark times, you know, because it was in the wake of the failed revolution. So politically, it was absolutely no fun whatsoever. And given the role of the university in its outbreak, as you mentioned, you know, the university was also tightly supervised in that respect. So those were not very good times, yes. But we, you know, mostly focused our attention on, at that time, on trying to survive the university somehow. It was so difficult. The workload was extreme. And as I said before, you know, it all turned out to be useful for later life, because never again have you ever been overloaded in that way. You know. Yeah, other about the revolution, what else have I experienced? The outbreak is very interesting. You know, one day before in high school, October 22, some students say that there will be a revolution. We said, what? And voila, the next day the revolution broke out. So I was still wondering, you know, how did they know? Well, maybe they listened to the radio or something, you know. So those were very amazing times, obviously.
Of course, unless there's anything else you want to say about that.
One more thing, you know, 99.99% of everyone I knew was for it. So... just completely obvious that everyone was on one side at the time, at least anyone I knew or met or heard of.
I was curious about, you mentioned that the workload and the intensity of the classes and laboratories kind of increased the first, second, and third years, and then maybe kind of leveled off a little bit.
Yeah, they kind of probably got used to it, and also, you know, we started to have less number of classes, more like, for example, we spent a few months in companies. We had projects to work on, little research projects or engineering projects. So it became more, a little bit more practical. Yeah.
How did you go about looking for a position for when you were going to be finished with the university?
It's another very interesting thing looking back. How, you know, I found a fantastic position. There was a research institute it was called Research Institute for the Organic Chemical Industry. And it was right downtown in the middle of Budapest. Every Hungarian at that time wanted to somehow move to Budapest if they just could do it. And that was really the place to be. And this research institute was a very well-known research institute, smack in the middle of town, fantastic place. So how did I get in there? It's kind of amazing. One of the fellow students, a lady, knew somebody who worked there. And the student told that gentleman who worked there that, you know, I would be interested in working there, and they invited me in, and we spent a very short time, like half an hour, discussing the matter, and they say, okay, you can start on September 1. In hindsight, you know, this is too completely amazing. But it did happen exactly that way, you know. So I got a phenomenal job, you know, just by dropping in.
That's excellent.
You know, there was really no majorly organized job search. Most people, as I remember, were kind of assigned to companies. At least that's my memory. You know, in your last year, you had to, I have to say this, you had to choose a sub direction. So the pharmaceutical industry in Hungary was at that time very significant, relatively speaking. So some people were assigned to work in the pharmaceutical companies. There were several around Budapest. Then there were other chemical companies, oil companies, etc., and research institutes. So in most cases, people were assigned. But somehow this way of me finding this job, I was not assigned to anywhere because I told them I already have a job.
So your plans to become a physician had kind of dissipated?
I'm sorry?
Your plans to become a physician had sort of dissipated?
In the high school, yeah, that kind of faded away. I gradually became more interested in wanted to be an engineer. You know, in the U.S. it is a kind of a different thing because it is extremely difficult to get into medical school in the U.S. and the medical professions remuneration practices are also rather different from engineering salaries typically. So there is this huge, you know, drive in the U.S. to try to get into medical school. The exact thing, same thing happened in engineering in Hungary. Mm-hmm. If you really wanted to make it, you would try to get into that engineering school. That was viewed at that time to be much more difficult and at least, you know, in our house, more prestigious mm-hmm. at that time. Whether it is true or not, I cannot tell you, but in our family, the biggest thing you could have possibly achieved is to become an engineer. Yeah. And it was very difficult to get in there.
Well, by the time, since your brother was younger, he must have felt even more pressure and excitement to try and get into the program.
Yes, and at the first try, he could not get in, didn't have enough points. So you could get credits against your points by doing physical work. So he worked in a chemical factory for a year. And then when he tried again, he got in. But this is not a reflection of he being less smart than I was. It is a reflection of me being more lucky than he was.
Well, and as you said, the exam and the education there was extremely difficult. So
yeah,
certainly
difficult.
No.
And only, you know, the other interesting aspect is that only a very, very small fraction of high school students ended up in universities, and a small fraction of elementary school students went to high school. So the typical level at that time was elementary school, yeah. 8 years. So those were very different times.
So when you had this 30-minute interview, they said show up to work on September 1st.
Yeah.
What was it that you did there? What was the experience there like?
We were doing process research, chemical process research. We were working on polyester, trying to develop a polyester process. It started with toluene oxidized to benzoic acid and convert the benzoic acid to terephthalic acid, and then react it with polyethylene glycol to make polyester. And my job was at the front end, the conversion of toluene to benzoic acid. Specifically, my subtask was to somehow figure out how the reaction products can be analyzed with the gas chromatograph. So gas chromatography was brand new at that time, you know, we're talking about 1964, and there may have been only very few gas chromatographs in Hungary at that time. We had to build our own columns, we had to build our detectors using light bulbs, which we operated out the innards of a light bulb, you know, and put a heated wire, a hot wire, on a monitor inside structure. And had to synthesize your own column materials.
Wow.
You know, so, and also the carrier, I remember we powderized bricks, Chamotte type of bricks, and synthesized, you know, the carbovax or whatever you wanted to put on your column, and built your detector, etc. And I remember one of the greatest treasures we had was the Hamilton syringes. That was an absolute treasure, you know, a Hamilton syringe. So it was held by our department head, you know, and you had to, when you wanted to use the Hamilton syringe, you know, you had to qualify, boy, if you bend the needle, you know, it was a disaster. So I remember I learned how to properly insert the needle through the septum, you know, which was silicone rubber. That was another kind of valuable thing. And then we had a strip chart recorder, which I remember cost 3 or 4 times my annual salary.
Wow.
So anyway, I figured it all out and put it all together, and it worked very well.
Where did you guys acquire the Hamilton syringe that was so... Was it that it was difficult to come by, or that it was so expensive?
Both. Somehow somebody bought it from the West, obviously.
Yeah.
It's an American company. But it was just something extremely valuable at that time.
I'm sure they would love to know how valued their syringes were.
Yeah. But, you know, I enjoyed the research very much. It was just totally wonderful to work there, you know. It was very, very nice. We had a huge degree of freedom, I remember. Mm-hmm. What we want to do, how do we want to do it, etc. They're smart people, so enjoyed that year there.
You mentioned that when you were at university, it was 6 days a week, pretty much all day.
Yeah.
What were kind of your hours like when you started moving into the professional world? Were you still working, you know, all day, all the time?
No, it was 8 hours Monday through Friday, and I think my memory is that we were like off at like Saturday at 2 p.m. or so. Mm-hmm. So we got like a couple of hours off on the sixth day. So you could go out Saturday evening, you could go out, and then Sunday was yours. But it was basically a 6 day. And that was also the case in Western Europe at that time, and probably in the US as well.
Did you have any opportunity or means to go home? You said that Sorinok was about 100 kilometers.
That is a very interesting question. 100 kilometers was like not quite the moon, but let's say halfway to the moon. There were two trains, you know, the express train and the regular train. The express train was just way too expensive for a student. The regular train took 4.5 hours. So if you divide 100 by 4.5, you realize that train moved very slowly. And in fact, you could jump out of it and jump back, almost. So yeah, you did that maybe certainly for Christmas and summer break. I don't remember doing it ever in mid-semester, but I may have. It was basically perceived to be a tremendous distance. We had one telephone on each floor of this dormitory. In theory, you could have called Hope from there, but we never figured it out because you needed to put in coins, not money, but a specific type of coin, and it would have been probably a very large number. So you went to the post office, and in the post office, you know, there were cabins, and you signed up for a call to Sorinok. A huge crowd, of course, you know. And then they finally shouted, "Sorinok cabinate, Sorinok cabinate," and you had to work your way through the crowd to the cabin. And then, you know, you had to listen in as they were plugging from town to town to town to town, you know, "Abony, Abony." And finally, you know, you connected with home. And your mother, "My son, my son." Big excitement. You could talk like for 3 minutes, and you know, it was a significant portion of your monthly allotment. So, you know, you didn't do this too frequently. So, yeah, it was, we were far away, very far away. Yeah. It was interesting, you know, to suddenly. You know, you spend your first 18 years with your parents and then suddenly being so well isolated from them, you know, was difficult transition,
Yeah. Your parents also probably figured you couldn't get into too much trouble considering how busy you would be.
No, they were very supportive, and they, of course, wanted to talk. My father often came up to Budapest.
Hmm.
And I remember many times we went out to have lunch. He liked a nice restaurant, so we always went to some nice cafe-style restaurant, you know. He bought me a great lunch always, you know, I remember that. It's very pleasant. And then he went back. You know, at that time, you wouldn't even think of a hotel. You know, what do you mean? You know, it was just, it was perceived to be only for foreigners, basically. You know. So he came up with the train, had lunch, and went back with the train.
Yeah. Wow.
Funny sort of story for you, how little language we may have had. Whenever I came up from Szolnok to Budapest at the train station, as you were leaving, there was a transparent sign, TIXE, T-I-X-E. See it for a few years. And once I looked back, and turns out it's exit looking from the other. After several years, I was always wondering, what the hell is TIXE?
Well, I'm glad that you were able to figure it out.
Just on the side, you know.
Yeah, right. Getting back to your time at the Research Institute of Organic Chemical Industry, once you got that GC machine working,
okay.
You know, how long did something like that take? What was the, you know, you weren't at that position for that long.
Yeah, I spent from September 64 to June 65.
Okay.
Yeah, I got it together. It, you know, there was work before me. I didn't start absolutely from scratch. I just, you know, picked up on the work and continued and, you know, get it running. And, it also had a flame ionization detector, you know, to be technical. And mysteriously, occasionally, it had a big negative peak going. Mm-hmm. You know, going negative rather than positive. So we were wondering, what is this? And we eventually correlated it with the secretary of our boss, who wore a lot of perfume. And of course, the flame ionization detector, you know, has an air supply, drew the air from the lab air. So whenever she passed by there, you know, with her perfume, the FID would be the departure. We were joking about that, you know.
So what happened that caused you to leave that institute?
Well, you know, many of us were dreaming about the West, and I was dreaming about the West. It was difficult, you know, circumstances at that time, in many different ways. You did not really see much future or hope, and so I was really hoping to somehow come to the West. In the summer of 64, after finishing school, but before starting at the Research Institute, a friend of mine and I, we drove our motorcycle to East Germany, all the way across Czechoslovakia, and Berlin, and then to the North Sea and back.
Oh, wow.
It is like, you know, landing on the Mars or something. Extremely complicated thing to do at that time with a 4.5 horsepower motorcycle, which is a good lawnmower here. So anyway, we were in Berlin, and we were on at the Brandenburg Gate. And the Brandenburg Gate separated east from west. Right? And we were on the eastern side. And of course, it was heavily reinforced. There were all kinds. kinds of fortifications on the eastern side, but it could get close enough on the Unter den Linden, the road which leads there at the end, that you could see through the Brandenburg Gate and could see the west. And this friend of mine and I said, whatever it takes, we'll somehow make it there. And so it did. So it did, both of us, in different ways. But yeah.
How, I mean, you did make it there, and I assume that was difficult. But how did that come about that you?
Well, basically, the situation started to loosen up in Hungary in 64 already. They gave out passports to travel to the West as tourists, and. Most people, or many people, applied in 64, and I didn't, because I considered it to be kind of hopeless. But in 65, three of us, friends, we decided to apply. One friend, he was turned down because, probably because he had no family, he was an orphan, and probably they must have felt that they, don't have anyone to hold liable if he doesn't return. And two of us, a mechanical engineer friend and I, to our absolute amazement, obtained the permission to spend a month in Austria, Germany, with kind of planned a round trip. You had to submit, what are you going to do, and show, eventually show also that you bought round trip tickets. So we said Italy, Austria, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, back Austria, back to Hungary, so both train ticket. And you got $50, which was worth about 2 months of your salary at that time. So you got $50 of hard currency, and to our amazement, we passport, and we say that we will see, we will try our best somehow to, to somehow stay there. So it's a very long story, to when you are 24 years old, how you think. The absolute first thing we wanted to do before anything else is to go to a place in Italy called La Spezia. It's on the Riviera. We saw this movie with Vittorio Grossman driving around a white convertible Lancia Aurelia on the cliffs of La Spezia. And we said, whatever happens after, we don't care. First, we want to go to La Spezia at all costs. So we did. And once we have done that, then we say, oh my God, what should we do next? And you look at the map of Europe and, the cities, etc. There is a huge glob of cities in the middle of Germany, in the Ruhr. Mm-hmm. Essen, Düsseldorf, Duisburg, Dortmund, Bochum, Mülheim, all these big cities, all in one place. And we said, well, if we want to find some work, we would want to go where most people are, because that's where the work is. So if you look at the map, in the middle of the whole thing is Essen. Mm-hmm. So get out of the railroad station, the train in Essen, and you sit on the steps and say, what should we do next? No money, no papers, don't know anyone. What do you do next? So it starts there, yeah. But eventually, I found a very good job. What you do, they give you some temporary, permit to work. So at that time, they were really, Germany was booming, so they were looking for help. And, you buy a newspaper and read the ads, try to learn German. And in a very short time, I had several offers, job offers. One was from Siemens in Munich, I remember. Other one was from Siemens in Karlsruhe. Other one was from a company called Öl Raffinerie in Mannheim, which was an oil refinery. Another one was a company called Standard Electric Lorenz, making TV tubes in Stuttgart. And then I had one from Daimler-Benz, Mercedes. And, when you grow up in Europe at that time, you were dreaming of a Mercedes. That was, absolutely, So I arrived, I accepted that job. They also had the highest offer. And I was to run a materials testing laboratory. Had 9 German technicians. At age 24, not speaking German, it's a remarkable thing. But, the country was growing like crazy, or the economy, they needed engineers. And so I arrived there on November, 2, 1965. And that was a Tuesday, because Monday was All Saints Day, and okay, it was a holiday, so it was Tuesday. And on Thursday, I ordered a brand new Mercedes. So, and I wrote to my father, that look what I have done, I just bought a Mercedes. And he wrote me back that, this is a difficult day for him to realize that the first time ever his son, he doesn't believe his son. I said, well, I'll send you a picture. He just couldn't imagine, that. Of course, we got a huge discount from the company, and didn't have to pay for it for a year. And a year later, you got a new one and gave this one back, so it cost nothing basically. Yeah.
When you applied for the tourist visas with your friends, and you had these intentions of hopefully staying in the West, did your family know that was your plan? Or your goal?
I did not want to put them on the spot. I am sure they knew it, but I felt that, my parents were very extremely honorable and straightforward people, and I didn't want them to lie. So I did not really tell it to them directly. I disallowed them to tell the truth that they did not know, but I was very secure in thinking that. The picture which is in my mind, when I left Szolnok, my parents came to the railroad station, and I remember them waving, and I'm sure they weren't sure if we will see each other for a while. Mm-hmm. Right, so it was a very, as the train moved away and they disappeared on the horizon, I thought, my God, when will I see them again? Because the Iron Curtain was at that time basically impenetrable. Yeah. But, it worked out just wonderful. you have to be an optimist. Especially when you are that young, you know, you think completely differently. You know. When you get older, you learn what is called the mountaineering technique of life, you know, three extremities on the rock, one extremity moves at a time, you know. But at that time, you know, you are, when you are so young, you know, you and so worried about things. Nothing to lose, basically, or not much. Yeah.
Well, perhaps this is a good time to take a little break.
Okay.
Get some more coffee or water, or use the restroom or anything
like that. Yeah, thank you.